but it made just the right kind of story that way. Ricky's leg had been shattered by Jack's golf club, both papers using the same verb. Ricky's wife, Nita, was at his bedside and said he couldn't talk because he was in too much pain, although the more florid of the papers said he was in agony. Jack's attorney, Marcus King, said, "When all the facts are known, my client will be cleared of all charges." Nita said, "Somebody has to pay for this." "Your father was there. He says it was an accident," Nora said to Rachel.
"Mom, please, how do you accidentally break someone's leg with a golf club? This is all because of that stupid parking lot, isn't it? Have you gone to see Ricky? Is he going to be okay?"
Nora had asked Charity the same question. She had refused to answer directly.
"Faucet dripping in Rachel's bathroom," Charity said darkly. "Dryer vent not working so good. Drain slowing back."
Charity had a marked tendency to be aphoristic. Charlie had once asked if they could buy her some verbs for Christmas, and when she returned to work Monday, it had deepened noticeably. She made it sound as though all the things they would have called Ricky to fix over the course of 6 months had now happened all at once, now that Ricky was gone, his men with him. Charity said that he was still in the hospital.
"Which one?" Nora asked.
"Big one," she said. "Uptown."
Charity seemed to hold Nora at least partially responsible for Ricky's injury.
"Charity will be so upset," Nora told Rachel. "She should be upset. Mr. Fisk is a scumbag. We used to pretend he wasn't when all he was doing was screaming at Mrs. Fisk. But come on, he put Ricky in the hospital. And Dad is standing up for him? Excuse me, but if Dad had been blocking the entrance to the lot, Mr. Fisk would have come over and discussed it with him. He wouldn't have beaten him with the golf club. And Charity won't quit because, duh, me and Ollie. But she should quit. This is all because Ricky is brown and poor."
Nora did not speak. She and Charlie had made a pact long ago that they would maintain a united front with the children, no matter what. She had never been so tempted to throw the agreement aside, to say to Rachel, "Your father is wrong. Jack Fisk is a terrible person who did a terrible thing. I can barely stand to look at your father when he defends him."
"Mom," said Rachel.
"I keep wondering how Ricky is feeling," Nora said.
"So go see him and find out. Tell him Ollie and I are worried about him. Tell him none of us believe this ridiculous accident story. I'm going."
An hour later, it was Christine on the phone.
"Have you seen the papers?" she said.
"Of course I've seen the papers. I'm beside myself. I'm exhausted by the papers."
"Exhausted? I'm excited. We're going to have people working double shifts to meet the demand."
"What are you talking about?" Nora said.
"The First Lady. You didn't see the First Lady? She led an exercise class wearing the Candide pants and top. We're going to be swamped."
Nora owned both. The pants said, "The best of all possible worlds" in the waistband. The shirt said, "Cultivate your garden." Nora sometimes wondered what Voltaire, resurrected, would think of all this. But the shirt was a slim cut with raglan sleeves, and the pants had a good rise and laundered well, so she decided not to fret about dead French philosophers.
"What did you think I was talking about?" Christine said.
"The golf club attack."
"He lost me none."
Nora was relieved. At least Jack, Ricky, and the block had not gone completely national. Nora narrated the story, and because it was Christine, she also told her she thought Jack's version was a self-serving lie and that it would serve him right to go to jail.
"Isn't Jack Fisk that really obnoxious man with the loud voice?" Christine said. "He was yelling at his wife because she was going to make them late for a restaurant reservation or something."
"He's horrible," Nora said.
"You think?" Christine said.
"Mrs. Alma wants you to call her,"
Charity said.
"Mrs. Fenstermacher wants me to call?"
Nora asked.
"What I said." "Obviously, I chose a bad weekend to visit the grandchildren," Alma Fenstermacher said, pouring tea.
Nora should have known that when Alma invited you to tea, it wasn't boiling water and a bag and a mug. There were individual single strainers, tiny cucumber sandwiches, scones, and clotted cream. It reminded Nora of the tea she'd once had at a hotel in Oxford.
"The Randolph," Alma said when Nora said it aloud. "The best afternoon tea in the British Isles. Sometimes we take the train from London just to walk around the colleges and have tea there." Nora realized that what had happened on the block was monumental, if the Fenstermachers wanted details. Alma never gossiped, never stood with her dog on the pavement and muttered, "Did you hear what those new people are doing to the backyard of 445? Nora described what she'd seen, and Alma sighed and said, "I'm sorry it came to that. I hope Ricky's injury is not too terrible. We never used him much, but he seemed like a lovely man." Nora had noticed that the Fenstermachers rarely used Ricky, but she assumed that that was because nothing in their house ever broke. She also assumed they never read the tabloids. The Times, the Wall Street Journal, neither had written about what had happened, but the tabloids had sunk their pointed teeth into it and wouldn't let go. Part of that was bad timing. 2 weeks before, the police had stopped a man in Upper Manhattan and shot him 6 times after, they said, he pulled a gun from his pocket. The gun turned out to be a cell phone. There had been a demonstration on 125th Street at which thousands of people had held their phones in the air. An accident at the George Washington Bridge, caused in part by the traffic occasioned by the demonstration, had resulted in the paralysis of a mother of 3 from Westchester County. The smoking phone story, as the Post had termed it, had run out of steam several days before. Nature abhorred a vacuum, and so did the tabloids. Their block was such an easy and convenient target. Had none of them ever noticed that everyone who lived there, every single one, even the renters, was white, and that everyone who worked for them, every single one, was black or Latino? Nora remembered telling her sister that when she had advertised for a nanny, not a single applicant was white. "So wait, you were worried when you hired Charity because you somehow thought it was racist to offer a black woman a good job?" Christine had said. "Does that make any sense? Especially if she wants the job?" "All the nannies are black and all the children are white. Does that make any sense?" "I guess, kind of," Christine said. "Charity is an immigrant, right? Immigrants work hard for us to someday get to be us. Someday their children will be hiring nannies of their own. Besides, if these women need the work, who are you to second-guess them? That's racist for sure." "So you have lots of people of color working for your company?" There was a silence. "Well, it's a smallish business," Christine finally said. "So that would be a no." "Are we counting Asians?" "No," Nora said. "Why are you suddenly worrying about this?" Christine asked. "This is like the time your lunch group had that big discussion about whether it was wrong to call Charity your housekeeper instead of the housekeeper." "I don't understand why," Suzanne had said. "I call Hal Bancroft my lawyer and Dr. Cohen my gynecologist." "My trainer," said Jean Ann. "My waxer," said Elena.
"Your waxer?"
Jenny said. "You blondes have no idea," Elena said. "Honestly, Nora, I love you, but you're overthinking this," said Jean Ann. "Or," Christine added, "that time you called Charity an African-American and she got huffy and said she wasn't African, she was Jamaican, and you raised her salary by $50 a week because you felt guilty." "I'm just trying to be a good person here," Nora cried. "First of all, you are a good person. And second of all, what does any of this have to do with being a good person? And third of all, I think you pay Charity more than most of our designers here make."
"The haves versus the have-nots," the Post said. "The deadly dead end."
Charity was annoyed at being described as a have-not. Charlie kept complaining that deadly suggested Ricky had been killed. He was also annoyed by the Daily News, which had come up with a picture of Jack at a golf course somewhere with the headline, "Welcome to the Club."
"That's not even the club he was carrying," Charlie said at breakfast when he saw it.
"Charlie, do you think anyone cares whether he almost beat a man to death with a wood or an iron?" Nora said.
"He didn't beat him almost to death. He was hitting the side of the van. He hit Ricky when Ricky stepped in front of the door."
"That's his story and he's sticking to it," Nora said, throwing the paper down so that it landed half on Charlie's cereal bowl and spit milk onto his shirt.
"I was there, Nora. I saw it happen."
"And he'll have one of those Sharpies from his firm represent him, and he'll wind up getting off."
"If it was an accident, he should get off."
"As long as we don't have to pretend we think that's what happened."
"It is what happened. I told the police that, and if I have to, I'll say it in court."
"Are you crazy? You know Jack Fisk.
He's got a temper so bad that he flies into a rage if a cab doesn't see him at the corner. He was screaming about Ricky and his van for months before this ever happened. An accident? I took the party line on the phone with our daughter, and I was embarrassed afterward.
I know what I saw, Nora,
Charlie said, putting his suit jacket on.
Just because you have a different version doesn't mean you're right.
It's not a different version, Nora said as the front door slammed. It's the truth. The Fenstermacher holiday party had for many years been a grand tradition on the block. It was always held on the second Saturday of January and featured the sort of food everyone loved and no one served anymore. Baked ham, biscuits, macaroni and cheese that tasted of cheese, not as though it had been leached of all flavor by the roving band of punitive nutritionists and gluten purists who had taken New York by storm. The guest list was confined almost entirely to the residents of the block, a judge, a shrink, some finance guys, some lawyers, two doctors, a freelance writer, a freelance graphic designer, a freelance artist, and the director of a museum. There were no public school teachers or police officers for the obvious reason that by any sensible non-Manhattan standard, everyone in the room was what had once been called rich. They were rich, but they had no money. It was all in their houses. At the door, Harold Lessman said to Nora,
I'm told you two are going to work for the legendary Bob Harris.
That's what everyone says, Charlie said.
It's not true, said Nora, hoping the party hadn't just been ruined for them both as her husband went in search of eggnog. She was, frankly, a bit surprised that Alma had not canceled the party. It was a month since what had now come to be referred to on the block, if it was referred to at all, as the parking lot incident. And although the reporters had moved on, there was still an oddly uncomfortable feeling among them all, as though they were somehow complicit in what had happened. On the other hand, the cancellation of the Fenstermacher holiday party would have been an enormous concession, a dark turning point. Apparently, the party had been going on for decades, long before the Nolans had moved onto the block. It was not exactly difficult to score an invitation, but the guest list was selective, composed of what Alma once called habitués. A renter would be hard-pressed to be included unless in residence for some time, usually with a family and a pleasant way of greeting people on the block, almost always with a dog. Even a new buyer of one of the brownstones might have to wait a year or two after taking title. Apparently, there had been one couple who had lived on the block for 5 years and had never been invited because somehow Alma knew that the husband also owned a co-op on Riverside Drive in which his girlfriend and their young son lived. And she was not having any of that. That first year the Nolans lived on the block, when she felt she was still auditioning to be a block habitué, Nora had asked Edward Fenstermacher if they had ever missed a year, but he said no, never. They had thought about canceling the party in 2002, but Alma had concluded that after the destruction of the World Trade Center and the pall it had cast over the city and its people, the party was needed more than ever. That year, they had invited all the firefighters from the nearby firehouse, which had lost 7 men when the Twin Towers collapsed, and nearly all of them had come. I'll be the first to admit it. I wept when I saw them, Linda Lessman had said. 5 years ago, there had been a blizzard the night before, snow wafting down like enormous feathers for hours until the cars were nothing more than soft, curved contours up and down the block. The caterers canceled, but Ricky and two of his men showed up to clear the sidewalks, and Edward Fenstermacher sent them out for pizzas, and with all of the cookies and candy Alma had made for the holidays arrayed on the table amid the poinsettias, it had actually been very jolly. When Nora and Charlie had left that party, the block was still impassable, quiet and lovely as a church. The tunnel of street trees leaning conspiratorially toward one another with their burden of snow. The plows, a distant buzz on the busier thoroughfares. Oliver and Rachel and some of the other kids pulling one another down the center of the street on sleds. And they had all agreed that it was a special occasion, the perfect end to the season. The Christmas holidays were, like so much else in the city, both wonderful and weird. Most New Yorkers complained incessantly about the traffic and the crowds that clogged Fifth Avenue looking at the holiday windows, and yet almost without knowing it,
A Christmas spirit crept into their activities, tree-trimming parties, garlands, and wreaths at the doors. The city exerted its customary fiscal hold on its residents and turned Christmas into a bonus round, with envelopes for the postman, the super, the housekeeper, the doorman. Every year, Nora gave Ricky a fat envelope with instructions to dispense as he saw fit to his various men.
"You're naive," Jack Fisk had said. "He'll just keep it all himself."
Charity, who was given 2 extra weeks' salary every year, and her family sent to Fruit Basket. The closest Nora had ever come to visiting Charity at home was typing her address into the order form, snorted at Jack's remark.
"Dotman don't know Ricky," she had said.
One day Nora stopped in front of Phil, the faux homeless man, who had a new sign, "No room at the inn, Merry Xmas." "You are completely shameless," she said, and he grinned.
"Come on, I'm creative, admit it," he said.
"Does it help?"
"Hard to tell," he said, blowing his nose. "Everybody says you take in more between Thanksgiving and Christmas."
"The holiday spirit," Nora said.
"Guilt,"
Phil said. "You know there's a man at the other end of the block now," Nora said.
"Yeah, I know. It's fine."
"Is he a real homeless person?"
"If you mean does he live in a shelter, then yeah. If you mean does he spend all the money he makes on booze, that too. If you mean that you would prefer that I be that kind of guy, I'll pass. You have to ask yourself why you care about that so much."
"Authenticity?" Nora said. Phil snorted.
"We're in New York," he said. "You want authenticity? Move to Des Moines."
"You think people are more authentic in Iowa?"
"Nah, not really. That's just one of the things we tell ourselves, right?"
Nora looked up the block. The man at the far corner looked like a pile of old clothes someone had put out for the trash. You could scarcely tell that there was a person inside the heap of sweatpants, flannel shirts, jackets, and hats. "He's going to freeze to death," she said. Nora looked up at the sky, which was the color of an old T-shirt, the kind Charity turned into a cloth to oil the furniture. Looking up at the sky was an effort. You had to search for an opening. Cranes, water towers, high-rises, cornices. Ah, there it was.
"It's not really that cold yet," Phil said. "And he's got a good down jacket. It has a little rip in it, but he put some duct tape over it. You people throw out a lot of good stuff."
"You people?"
"Yep."
Charity thought the same. Twice a year she muttered about how crowded the basement was getting. Barely room for a person to move. Hard to iron things right. This was Nora's cue to stack up clothes that were no longer needed, usually hers, usually because they had been a mistake in the first place. She often wound up wondering why she ever thought she would wear something pink or pale blue. It was as though from time to time she imagined herself a completely different person, not who she really was, in her black and occasional gray. Even her dog was black and gray, with the dolor relieved by the odd patch of white. She had always been the same weight, a little slender, a little hippie, so that her blouses were a size smaller than her pants, and she had worn her hair the same way for 3 decades, shoulder length, cut blunt, ponytail or bun. Once, years ago, she had gotten a shorter, layered cut, and when she went to pick Rachel up at school, Rachel had burst into tears. She never made that mistake again, but she somehow continued to buy clothing from time to time that would have been perfect for someone else living somewhere else, somewhere where people wore pastels. Charity took these misguided purchases to her church, which apparently was unusually active during Christmas week, and where apparently everyone loved a lively yellow or a horizontal stripe. Charity was agnostic about most holidays, even Thanksgiving, but she always took off the last 2 weeks of December. Before she left, she would bring them 2 of her traditional fruitcakes, which had been percolating in a closet somewhere in her apartment for the entire year, the process of making them beginning as soon as the preceding Christmas celebration was done. Once a month, a jigger of rum was poured atop and then the cake put back into hibernation. And while Charity insisted that the alcohol got gone fast, as she liked to put it, the aroma of the cakes was so strong that once they arrived, the kitchen smelled like a tiki bar for a week. The great Christmas lecture the Nolans had had to give their children, along with the warning that if they revealed to their younger cousins there was no Santa, there would be terrible consequences,
was that they had to tell Charity how good the fruitcake was. Although after the first year, when Charlie and Nora had tasted it and spit it back onto their plates, it had gone directly into the garbage disposal. Not the garbage, since Nora invested Charity with magical powers and believed she would be bound to find the garbage bag with the cake inside.
What if we brought the fruitcake to the Fenstermachers?
Charlie had said the first year they were invited to the holiday party across the street, and Nora had said, "Are you insane?" Now every year he said it as a joke.
"And so another year has come and gone," Alma said, standing at the foot of the mahogany banister in a green velvet dress with a bejeweled holly brooch on one shoulder, opening her arms. Her hair was always freshly done in a style that hadn't been popular for 30 years and yet looked fine on Alma. Nora's mother had had an expression, "She looks like she just stepped out of a bandbox." Nora did not know then and had never learned since what a bandbox was, but she was certain Alma looked like she had just stepped out of one. It was funny how different it was seeing people you saw every day on the sidewalk at a party instead. There were air kisses, some one cheek, some two. People who had grown up in Kansas City greeted one another in New York as though they were Parisian. There was even a man in Charlie's firm who kissed 3 times. Cheek, other cheek, original cheek. You never knew what you were going to get. There were big vases full of pine boughs and garlands on the landing and mantels. The Fenstermachers had a tree in their front window that charmed from the street. Its constellation of white star lights glimpsed through the glass, and a phalanx of poinsettias down the center of their very long dining room table.
"We should have a holiday party," Charlie said every year, and Nora just ignored him.
That royal "we" always meant, "I like the idea," which meant, "You should take care of it. We should get a new sofa. We should replace the garbage cans." Besides, anyone on the block who attended the Fenstermacher party knew that to hazard their own was an exercise in hubris. Nora always enjoyed the party, and she thought it was telling that the twins complained now that their school schedules meant they could not attend. Even when they were in high school and sometimes acted as though they would prefer to eat ground glass rather than go anywhere with their parents, they always stopped in at the Fenstermacher holiday party, although they arrived and left on their own.
"You should get her mac and cheese recipe, Mom," Ollie had said once.
"Oh my goodness, honey, that whole party is catered."
"Really?"
Rachel said.
"It doesn't feel like it is."
Which was perhaps the nicest thing a born and raised Manhattan child could say about a meal.
"Ms. Marathon,"
said George, sidling up to Nora at the drinks table, which unfortunately was in a corner, which meant Nora was trapped. Forced proximity to George was the only downside to the holiday party.
"Is Betsy here?"
Nora asked. George's wife, Betsy, was an almost mythic figure on the block. She was a thoracic surgeon, apparently involved in lung transplants for children with cystic fibrosis, the kind of job that made Nora feel thoroughly ashamed of what she herself did for a living. Occasionally, when Nora was running very early because of a breakfast meeting, or coming home very late because of an event, she would see Betsy across the street and wave. Seeing her always made Nora wonder 3 things. How hard was it to find a pair of lungs to transplant into a small child? Did transplanted lungs grow along with the child, or did you need to someday replace them with a larger adult-sized pair? Why would anyone, who was a thoracic surgeon, be married to someone as annoying and apparently aimless as George?
"Unfortunately, no," said George, as he always did. "She had a patient who spiked a fever. In her line of work, that can be a life-and-death issue."
No one was sure what George's line of work was. Like most people in New York whose profession was murky, he described himself as a consultant. But no one had ever seen him in a suit and tie, and the only thing he seemed to consult about was the business of the block.
"In the interest of a uniform appearance, it has been suggested," by whom no one had any idea, "that the tree surrounds on the block be provided with the same plantings throughout. A garden wholesaler in Westchester County," probably some friend of George, to the extent that George had actual friends, "has agreed to provide flats of impatiens and wax begonias at wholesale prices, which would be picked up by Ricky and installed by him at a reasonable cost."
Nora would never forget that one.
She had gone out the same day, bought masses of pink geraniums, and planted them thick around the tree just outside their front door.
"Someone didn't get the memo,"
George said the next morning, and instead of feigning ignorance, Nora said curtly, "I hate wax begonias." The holiday party was one of the only places Nora could not avoid George. She started to move away, eggnog in hand, trying to ignore the mustache of cinnamon and nutmeg on George's upper lip, but George body-blocked her.
"Did you get a chance to say hello to Jonathan?"
he said.
"Jonathan!"
he called across the fence to mark her dining room.
"John! Mrs. Nolan! Come say hello!"
"He hasn't been home in a while, has he?"
"Busy living the dream,"
George said, as Jonathan threaded his way toward them, holding a clutch of carrot sticks and celery in his hand. "I wish Ollie and Rachel were here," Nora said to him. "They love this party. Ollie swears by the mac and cheese."
"Animal fat and carbs,"
Jonathan muttered.
"Fat and carbs."
"I suppose," Nora said, "but worth it."
"No, man,"
Jonathan said. He was wearing a t-shirt for a band called Municipal Waste and flip-flops. His ensemble was disconcerting, not so much, Nora thought, because it was just above freezing and threatening snow, but because Jonathan lived in a place where she assumed it was always freezing and threatening snow at this time of year. "How's Colorado?" she asked, to be sure he hadn't moved someplace tropical.
"He's living the dream,"
George said.
"He's into wellness and physical fitness. Clean eating. Clean living."
"Eat plants,"
Jonathan said. Nora was pretty sure that the twins were right and that Jonathan spent as much time smoking plants as eating them.
"He was up all night talking to his mother. Weren't you, Mr. Mountains? Yakking it up with your mom."
"Whatever,"
said Jonathan, shuffling toward the buffet table, perhaps to pass judgment on the ham and biscuits, animal fat and carbs. Nora could only imagine what he would think of the chocolate and butterscotch Yule log cake. She had taken a picture of it and sent it to the twins.
"Mommy, stop," Rachel had texted back.
"He seems good," Nora said, because even in George's case, the travails of parenthood forced her into kindness.
"Betsy got him back here. He's always too busy to visit, and he isn't really a city boy. Mountain man, you know, hiking, skiing, rappelling, the whole 10 yards.
Nora looked at Jonathan, who was scrutinizing a cherry tomato as though it were a crystal ball. Somehow she doubted it.
"I wanted to ask you a question,"
George said.
"Exactly how much were you paying Ricky?"
"You mean how much am I paying Ricky?" Nora said. "How much will I be paying Ricky when he comes back to work?"
"Whatever you say,"
George said.
"I get it. I hear you. Your better half told me you were Team Ricky."
"I'm Team Don't Bash People with Golf Clubs," Nora retorted, then looked around the room.
"They're not here," said George. "Don't worry."
"I'm not worried," Nora said, although she was, about upsetting Sherry, who she figured already had enough to put up with.
"You're avoiding the question,"
George said. "Don't we all pay Ricky the same?" Nora said. Actually, she knew that this was not exactly the case. Some people on the block, the Nolans included, paid Ricky in cash because that was what he preferred and there was no downside for them. Charlie said that even if he was asked to serve as deputy mayor for finance, really? Nora had said once when they were bickering over expenses, but backed off when she saw the look on his face. He could say that Nora had handled paying Ricky and that he had assumed it was being done properly. Nora had asked Bebe about whether she needed to start paying Ricky on the books because of the job at the museum.
"Are you going to be running for office anytime soon?"
Bebe had said, one eyebrow arching above the rim of her bright red reading glasses like an exotic punctuation mark. But the Lessmans paid Ricky by check because Linda was a judge, and so did the Fenstermachers when they used him, because their household expenses were paid out of some odd little family corporation. For those who insisted on what Charity called that government nonsense, Ricky levied a small surcharge.
"I think he's been jacking some of you up," George continued, shaking his head. "I'm trying to get a sense from everyone on the block of what they're paying him so I can make sure we really want to take him back and that he hasn't been abusing his position here."
"What position? The man does chores for all of us for what seems like a fair wage. It's not like we're doing him a favor, especially under the circumstances." George ignored her.
"Now, I don't know what your housekeeper is making,
What? Said Nora, and apparently hearing this as a question and not an exclamation, George came out with a figure far in excess of what they paid Charity, leading Nora to think that Charity either was paid far below market rates or was ginning up her salary for public consumption to inflate her standing on the block. Alma Fenstermacher, flawless as always, appeared at Nora's elbow and led her away.
Thank you, Nora breathed. What a nice person you are, to tolerate him every year.
Alma smiled.
Oh, I believe every party needs one crashing bore, she said. And Betsy is lovely.
She has a patient emergency.
She always has a patient emergency. I don't believe I've actually spoken to her for almost 2 years. There was a period there during which I suspected he had killed her and buried her under the back patio.
Do they have a patio? Nora said. George lived on the opposite side of the street from the Nolans, one house removed from the Fenstermachers.
Some awful artificial flagstone. Unfortunately, I can see the yard from our bedroom.
No one had ever actually been inside George's house, but it was widely understood to be a complete mess. George would hire contractors and then wind up trying to finish the job himself, badly. It was commonplace for New Yorkers to stiff the people who worked for them, but most of them were canny enough to wait until the job was completed and then offer 50 cents on the dollar. George was apparently dumb enough to argue with workmen before the job was completed, when they could see the stiffing coming. His house was half stripped to its original stone, half still covered in a layer of liverish red paint, because he'd so harangued the refinishers that the boss had just told them to pack up their scaffolding and leave. Jack Fisk had once said George's name was on more legal papers than the U.S. attorney's. The Fenstermacher's house, on the other hand, was predictably lovely. All the original detail had been restored to quiet glory, and the decor was vaguely Victorian without being slavishly so. New Yorkers who owned old houses tended to go in one of two directions, museum or tabula rasa, in both cases perhaps intimidated by the weight of history. Nora remembered when the insurance adjuster had come to assess the replacement value of the Nolans' new house soon after they'd closed on it.
You know it's a joke, right? He'd said, frowning down at his clipboard.
Nora knew. You couldn't replace this sort of house. People tried. Old brick from a magical place somewhere in central Pennsylvania. Oak flooring salvaged by the Amish. New cornices designed to look like old. Mantles taken from other houses. Somehow, you could always tell. With a house as old as theirs and a city as fluid as New York, the idea that it belonged to you was relative. Maybe that was why some people ripped everything out. Smooth, clean walls, steel banisters with bluestone treads. Undeniably theirs in a way nicked wainscoting turned from butterscotch to caramel with age never could be. A curator, who was an expert in city history, had told Nora at a book party that while the house where the Lessmans lived was once a brothel and the Dixons a small-time hat factory, the Nolan's house had been owned for almost 90 years by a single family. The Taylor House, he called it, as though to emphasize the Nolan's transience. The Taylors, a father, a mother, the mother's mother, three daughters, a son. Apparently you could find them memorialized in copperplate in some great leather-bound census book. The three daughters married and moved to what was then the country, now the suburbs. The parents died. The son stayed, single, and made his surroundings smaller and smaller until finally he was living in what was now Oliver's bedroom. He had had a hot plate, a cat, and six locks on the door. Only after they closed did Nora find out that he'd died there. Information she had kept to herself and would never reveal to a living soul.
With houses this old, every single one has had someone die in it, Alma Fenstermacher said when Nora first met her, unsolicited, as though to take the curse off, and Nora wondered whether Alma had actually known the last of the Taylors.
Elizabeth II, the poodle, nuzzled Nora's hand in which she clutched a cocktail napkin spotted with a bit of mustard.
No, said Alma. And Elizabeth backed off and sat down.
One more thing, George said, coming up behind Nora and Alma. But Alma said,
Oh, George, I think Edward had something he wanted to ask you.
And she and Nora circled around to the dessert table. Did you ever consider canceling? Nora asked, choosing a cookie.
Edward and I discussed it, Alma said.
I think we would have done so if it had been closer to the actual event. There's been such an atmosphere, hasn't there? But I thought canceling would make the atmosphere worse somehow.
That's what I thought, too, Nora said.
I'm glad you agree. I think Linda was a bit disapproving, but then she's so judgmental, which, from a professional point of view, makes perfect sense for a judge. She and her husband are here somewhere.
And the Fisks?
Alma sighed, her brooch rising and falling and catching the light from the chandelier and candle. I think I put a foot wrong there. I called Sherry to urge her to come. She looked so beaten down, poor thing. I said, Sherry, please, we want you there. She said, what about Jack? And I paused. She can't really have wanted to bring Jack here. I don't think so. I think it was a kind of litmus test. I suppose I failed. In any event, they're not here. Someone told me they've moved to their weekend place in Bedford for a while. Or maybe he has, and she goes out there from time to time. Alma sighed again. I hate it when things are unsettled on the block, she said. Let's retire the subject. I've got some food in the freezer for your children. They've always been so appreciative of the party, and I know they'll be home again before long.
They've always loved this party, Nora said, and she was not merely exhibiting Manhattan party politeness. She was still convinced that Rachel had dropped the determination to celebrate both Hanukkah and Christmas after just 1 year because of the centrifugal force of the Fenstermacher party. Christmas was an oddly a-religious holiday in most of the city, although when she walked Homer on the evening of the 24th, Nora was always faintly surprised and, if she was being honest, buoyed by the number of people she saw entering the Catholic church on the next block. The Fenstermachers always had a creche, but they kept it upstairs in the den so few guests ever saw it. Her own children had played with it 1 year as though it were some sort of fancy toy village, and Alma, coming upon them, had insisted that they continue.
I always wondered what you did with all the leftovers, Nora said. Most of them go to the SRO. They have a party the day after this party. The decor is not the same, sadly, but they seem to enjoy the food.
You're too good to be true, Nora said.
Well, we all have to do something, Alma said, picking up a petit four. I hope Sherry will be back next year, but not her husband. I draw the line there.
I hate February, Nora said to Charlie at breakfast.
There are places where we could live that are warm even in February, Charlie said.
Nora wouldn't make that mistake again. I hate February, Nora said to her lunch group, and Elena rolled her eyes.
Everyone hates February, she said, snapping a breadstick. Have you ever heard anyone say they loved February? If you did, would you ever have anything to do with them again?
God, you're in a great mood, Suzanne said.
I hate February,
Elena said, and winked at Nora. The good news is that whoever was putting dog poop on my stoop has stopped, Nora said.
Again with this? Elena said. How many times do I have to say, not at lunch, babe, not at lunch?
You sound like Charlie, Nora said.
That's just mean, Elena said,
and they all laughed. The really good news, Nora said, is that my assistant quit.
That's the good news? Jenny asked.
Oh, I hear you, said Elena, who ran a PR firm. I had one kid, when he aced his LSATs and decided to go to law school, I was happier than his parents. I was so glad to see the back of him.
Jean Ann said, one of my partners, I swear it's his favorite part of the job, calling some young associate in, saying, you may want to consider employment elsewhere. I've just never developed the knack. I'm always so relieved when they decide to quit and I don't have to fire them.
You're so lucky, Nora.
This is a depressing conversation, Jenny said.
Nora's assistant now was a temp named Richard. He was so thin that his clothes all looked as though they were still on hangers. When she had gotten in that morning, picking up the folder for a meeting with a vodka company that wanted to sponsor an exhibit of the Danish crown jewels, he held up a hand.
Your daughter is on the phone. She says it's urgent, he said, and then, seeing the look on Nora's face, added, in a girl way.
Do you have a sister? Nora asked him as she went into her own office.
I have six sisters, Richard said.
It seemed to Nora that it was always when she was late for a meeting that the phone rang and Rachel was on the other end with a crisis at once so profound and yet so fleeting that if Nora ignored it, it would be added to the grievance bank. And if she took it seriously, Rachel would say when she brought it up again that her mother exaggerated everything. In a girl way, she thought to herself. Richard had been working for her for only 3 weeks, and she already liked him infinitely more than she ever had Madison.
"I'm in so much pain," Rachel wailed, as though Nora could do something about it, with Rachel 4 hours away in Williamstown.
"Oh, Buggy Boo," Nora said, a relatively safe reply.
"I was in this rugby scrimmage yesterday."
"A rugby scrimmage? Why were you in a rugby scrimmage? Aside from everything else, it's not even rugby season." Not a safe reply.
"Mom, why do you always ask questions instead of just listening to me? I want you to listen to what I'm saying, and instead you just grill me, like I'm some criminal or something. I don't know why I bothered to call."
Nora was not sure either. She supposed she should be glad that Rachel still called her when she was overwrought, when she got a B on a paper in her major, when she and the current boyfriend had quarreled, when she'd strained something. It sounded like a hamstring, although Rachel was bound to think it was a compound fracture in a rugby game. Sometimes Rachel called Christine about these things, which hurt Nora's feelings, although she would never say this to either one. Oliver seldom called, and only with emergencies that he refused to characterize as emergencies. In a boy way, Nora supposed.
"Mom, do you know where my passport is?"
he'd asked the week before he was due to go to Oslo for a semester abroad. Luckily, Nora was well acquainted with a place that could, for a price, provide a new passport in 48 hours, having used it twice before for Oliver, once for Rachel, and even once for Charlie, when he had to fly to Tokyo on an emergent business matter and discovered that he had somehow let his passport expire. In New York City, you could find anything. There were women who would pick nits from a child's hair if there was an outbreak of lice at school, as there so often was. Christine thought she was kidding when she first told her. Nitpickers. Now they had them in Seattle, too. The last time Rachel had called Nora at work, Bibi had stood in the doorway of her office, tapping a foot in a black slingback stiletto. There were people who were careful not to let judgment register on their faces, particularly where motherhood was concerned. Bibi was not one of them. Her whole body was a semaphore. "Get off the phone. This is ridiculous. What am I paying you for?" "Kids," Nora said, putting down the receiver and shrugging. "There were so many reasons I never had them," Bibi said, "or had any interest in doing so. Husbands don't really care for them."
"And yet so many of them become fathers," Nora said coldly.
Bibi waved a hand. She was wearing a square-cut emerald so big no one would bother to steal it because it shouted fake. It had once belonged to some Indian royalty and had been Bibi's engagement ring, and so, for sentimental reasons, the woman is as sentimental as a crocodile, Nora had told her sister, she had decided not to give it to the museum. "Until I'm dead," she added unsentimentally.
"They become fathers because their wives insist on becoming mothers, although most of the ones I know had only one, just so they could say they had, you know, little Lindsay has changed my life, blah, 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 night nurse, nanny."
Thank God Bibi was away now and couldn't hear Nora talking to Rachel, nor see Phil sitting in a spot cleared by their facilities guy with the snowblower. The last time Bibi had noticed him was just before the holidays, as she stopped into the museum before she flew south.
"Go away," she'd yelled.
"Good morning, Mrs. Pearl," he said. "Nice morning."
"It's fucking freezing,"
Bibi said, pulling her mink coat tighter around her midsection. "Don't you ever take a snow day?" Nora had said to Phil when she got to the office.
"I've got all-wheel drive," he said.
"How did you wind up doing this in the first place?"
You know, like most things, it was a confluence of events," he said.
"A confluence of events?"
"What? Because you're homeless, you have to be stupid?"
"But you're not homeless. You have a home."
"Maybe I have a home because I do this," he grinned. "You gotta love a country where there are rules for being poor, and rich people make them."
"I'm not a rich person," Nora said.
"I'm inclined to take your word for that," he said. You're one of the only regulars who makes eye contact. Even a lot of the people who give me money won't make eye contact.
So, what was the confluence?
A divorce, the economic downturn, some medical issues, a problem with alcohol. I got it together, but it took a couple of years. When I first started, I was more, you know, like you think I ought to be.
That makes me sound terrible.
Nah, you're okay. Like I said, eye contact. Plus, like, right now, you're having a normal conversation.
Don't you ever consider...
What? I sit on the sidewalk with a sign. Maybe you think it's humiliating, but it's only humiliating if I feel humiliated, and I don't. What did Eleanor Roosevelt say? No one can make you feel inferior without your consent. And by the way, everything on the sign is true.
Need something to eat?
Hey, everybody needs something to eat. What about you? Don't you need something to eat? You walk all the way downtown in this cold?
Nora had. The garbage in the gutters was frozen into agonized attitudes as though the Cheez-Its bags and drinking straws had died of hypothermia. Even George's pugs stayed indoors in this weather, allowed to relieve themselves in the backyard because George insisted that they suffered terribly from the road salt that got into the tender creases of their paws. But still, Nora walked, waiting for the cold to weaken and wane. When the weather warmed, she would resent the bicyclists who suddenly reappeared, the runners who had been inside on treadmills while her earlobes were anesthetized by cold. But she always noticed that when the temperature warmed, she lived in the world more surely, looking at the buildings and the people around her. As soon as the winter wind began to blow up the Hudson Corridor, her head went down and her shoulders up. It was not something she noticed, really, until she felt her body unclenched sometime in March. Although this being New York City, people had even begun to pathologize the phenomenon. "He suffers from terrible seasonal affective disorder," a woman had said about her husband, who was a poet and thus assumed to have enhanced sensitivities. "He's a pain in the ass, even in June," said Jenny, when Nora mentioned the exchange. In the meantime, she bought one pair of gloves after another, slapping her hands together as she came down the block to restore feelings to her fingers. Seeing Linda at the corner in a gray coat waiting for a cab, wondering where Sherry was and whether she was away or simply avoiding the rest of them. There was an odd disconnect between their professional selves in dress shoes and tailored jackets and their everyday selves on the block. Those selves were the great equalizers. Just men and women in sweatshirts, wondering why the recycling guys always spilled half the plastics on the street, who it was who persistently refused to properly bag their garbage. George had once said he would mount a spy camera, but either he hadn't done it, it hadn't worked, or he hadn't caught the culprit. They could have been anything. German professors, nephrologists, sculptors. Nora had discovered that Linda was a judge not during conversation at the holiday party or on the street while walking their dogs, but by reading a story about a sentencing in one of the tabloids. She was certain she had once had a conversation with Linda about getting out of jury duty, but Linda had in no way suggested at the time that there was anything wrong with that. It was as though each of them was two people. Once, Nora had hypothesized jokingly that Alma Fenstermacher was a CIA operative. "If so, it's the best cover I've seen yet," said Sherry Fisk. "Yet?" Nora had yelped. All that was quite different from her own parents, who each was only ever a single person, as far as she could tell. Her mother was always a Connecticut housewife, partial to bridge parties and celery with cream cheese filling to serve at them, and her father, when at home, was not a different man from his work self, but simply waiting to be that self again, like a wind-up doll whose key had been removed from its back. When his appendix had burst, he was confined to his bedroom for a week after he left the hospital, and Nora and Christine hurried by the half-closed door as though, if they raised their heads, they would see something shameful. Douglas Benson in pajamas on a Tuesday afternoon. Their mother had always seemed to think of being a mother as a kind of pastime, like bridge or tennis. Most nights at dinner, she asked them to describe the best thing about their day, and most mornings at breakfast, she paged through their copybooks, although it was not clear what she was looking for, except for conspicuous misspellings, which had to be erased and corrected on the spot. But sometimes, when she was reading a magazine in the living room in the afternoon and they appeared, she would look up with a faintly puzzled expression on her face as though they were neighbors she'd invited for coffee and then forgotten about. Nora had felt sometimes that she should be grateful for her mother's vague and cordial disengagement. Jenny had shocked her by offhandedly telling stories of how her mother was always slapping her face, putting her on punishing diets, flirting with her boyfriends, how she had looked at one college rejection letter and said, "I never understood why you thought you'd get in there in the first place." Nora had come around to thinking that it was better to bear no marks at all than claw marks. The most resonant memory she had, for some strange reason, was of her mother leaning toward the bathroom mirror, patting her face lightly with a pink chamois powder puff over and over again, as though she were somehow comforting herself. While many of her friends had agonized about hiring help for their children, nailing themselves to the cross of motherhood and learning to resent their kids in the bargain, Nora had not thought twice about engaging a nanny, because of her own childhood, and Mary. For cookies after school, there was Mary, and for help with sharpening pencils, and for soup on winter vacation days, and ice pops on summer ones. Mary made cinnamon toast when they were sick, sewed the badges onto their Girl Scout sashes, and stacked the cotton underpants in their top drawers. For cuddling under the covers and talking about this and that, the two sisters had each other. "You don't know how lucky you are," Nora had said one evening to Rachel, when they were huddled under the lavender duvet talking about how mean the new girl in the fourth grade was. "I don't think my mother ever got into bed with me or my sister." "I wish I had a sister," sighed Rachel, who hated being told how lucky she was. "I love Aunt Christine." Nora believed that her sister was a better mother than she was, or at least a more natural one, and she knew why this was so. When Nora was 10, but her sister only 6, their mother had died. She had done that in the same half-hearted way that she had been a mother, fading out over the space of a few winter months, propped in bed in a lilac-colored housecoat surrounded by magazines. "She should be in the hospital," Mary said, and for the final weeks, she was, so that she disappeared from both their lives overnight and then, after Mary had cleaned out her closets, almost completely. There remained the hand-tinted wedding portrait hanging at the end of the upstairs hall, in which both of their parents looked stiff, a little uncomfortable, almost as though they had not yet been introduced. Nora always thought that her story was the opposite of every other dead mother story she'd heard since. A year later, their father had gone to Christine's parent-teacher conference. 6 months later, when school was out for summer, he had married the second-grade teacher. Of course, everyone talked about how, in what seemed like an instant, the universally liked Miss Patton had become the second Mrs. Benson. When Nora and her friends would go into the game room at the tennis club for sodas, it would sometimes fall silent, like a thud, and she would know that's what people had been discussing at the card tables. And naturally, since she was 11, the beginning of a time when, Nora now knew from experience, girls are as mean as sleet and should be cryogenically frozen and then reconstituted later, Nora had done her best to torture her stepmother. To begin with, she insisted for months on calling her Miss Patton. She had refused to let herself be persuaded of the reality until one day when she had come home late from field hockey practice. The house had a rich brown smell that turned out to be pot roast, and in the den, her sister and her sister's former teacher were sitting close together on the leather Chesterfield, reading Anne of Green Gables. On the coffee table was a plate of brownie crumbs and two mugs that had held cocoa. Cocoa, with marshmallows. Not the big ones that made an unwieldy lump in the cup, but the tiny ones that melted into soft little elevated puffs of sugar. Mary worked only part-time now, so the pot roast, the brownies, and the cocoa had all been produced by Miss Patton, whose name was Carol. "You can call me Carol," she had said when her father had suggested mother, but Christine already called her Mommy. Carol was more of a mother than her own mother had ever been. When Nora was in high school, she had heard Carol and her father talking in the living room one night when she came downstairs to get herself a banana from the bowl of fruit that always stood now on the kitchen counter.
"Did that honestly never occur to you?"
Nora heard Carol say, and her father said, I think it's a coincidence. Stella wasn't literary enough for something like that.
The sentence hadn't meant anything to her until college, when one of Nora's suite mates, a drama major, had said to her, How weird, you and your sister have the same names as the two main characters in A Doll's House. Do you think it's possible that our mother named us after characters in an Ibsen play? She'd asked her sister during semester break. You knew her a lot better than I did, Christine said apologetically. She always said that. Christine worried that Nora resented her closeness to Carol, the notion that, in a way, they had had different mothers. I don't think that's true, Nora said. She supposed it had shaped her view of marriage as well as motherhood. In the way that children always did, unless there was screaming and hitting involved, she had thought her parents were perfectly happy, watching her father drape a mink stole over her mother's narrow shoulders, seeing her mother tap her father on the arm when she thought he was going on too long about work. But then her father had married Carol, and she had seen what happiness really was. When she was a little girl, Nora had gotten a party favor that was a tiny, undifferentiated nugget of sponge. The instructions said to put it in a bottle and add water, and sure enough, it grew, swelled, became identifiably a bear. That was what happened to her father. Carol was the water. At their 25th anniversary party, when Nora's father had stood to give a toast, his daughters had seen him cry for the very first time. Now, while her friends discussed nursing homes and dementia, Nora kept quiet. No one wanted to hear that her father and his wife, just turned 75, almost 65, were on a river cruise up the Danube, sending texts to Rachel and Oliver, Vienna is amazing, and love from Budapest. Twice a year they spent a long weekend in the city, always staying at a hotel, but taking Charlie and Nora and, if available, the twins out to dinner and brunch. Nora remembered walking through Central Park with them after Sundays at Serendipity when the twins were small and still easily co-opted by hot fudge and free balloons, watching as Carol slipped her hand into her husband's and swung it slightly. Nora had felt such a spasm of envy that it almost made her faint. It was one of the only marriages she ever encountered that wasn't a mystery to her, even her own. When people divorced, she was often surprised, and when they stayed together, sometimes more so. She thought that people sought marriage because it meant they could put aside the mascara, the bravado, the good clothes, the company manners, and be themselves, whatever that was, not try so hard. But what that seemed to mean was that they didn't try at all. In the beginning, they all spent so much time trying to know the other person, asking questions, telling stories, wanting to burrow beneath the skin. But then you married and naturally were supposed to know one another down to the ground, and so stopped asking, answering, listening. It seemed foolish, 15 years in, to lean across the breakfast table and say, By the way, are you happy? Do you like this life? Familiarity bred contempt, she'd read somewhere, or at least inattention. But sometimes it seemed more like a truce without a war first. These are the terms of engagement. This is what it is. Let's not dwell on what's not. Want what you have, it said inside the waistband of one of Christine's bestsellers, some patterned capri pants. And it sounded so life-affirming until you really thought about it. And then it just sounded like capitulation. Sometimes Nora would look across the room at Charlie and feel the same way she did when she looked at her old oak roll-top desk and remembered how thrilling it had been to spot it across a dusty plane at an antique show, even though nowadays she mainly cursed its sticky drawers and splintery edges. That was how most people stayed married, she suspected. 9 parts inertia, and 1 part those moments when she spotted her husband sitting across a long table, illuminated by a votive candle, bending his head to listen to the blonde pianist next to him, bending as though he were deeply interested in her remarks about how terribly Juilliard had changed and how vitamins were really unnecessary if only you ate by the 1-2-3 method. Bending his fair head, as he once sat at a table in Montreal, when they were seated side by side and he said, Don't ever change a thing, bunny mine. Not one thing. Bending it now because he was beginning to lose his hearing a bit. All the men seemed more attentive at dinner parties these days because
They needed hearing aids and refused to get them. You could tell them you'd won the Nobel, her friend said, and they wouldn't react because they hadn't truly heard. Although how any woman stays married after she wins the Nobel is beyond me, said Kathleen from her lunch group. Charlie was still angry.